Welcome to All Ships Pod, and our guest this time is Dr. James Bosbotanis, who is a regular contributor to the magazine and also the books editor of the Naval Review, an esteemed publication, and a defence expert, a freelance defence expert with a lot of deep knowledge in very interesting areas. And in this episode of the podcast, we're going to look at what I would call the axis of bother, if you're the West, shall we say, what remains of the West, and that would be Russia, a bit of North Korea in terms of what we look at, but also we'll dive into China as well. So welcome, James.
Hi, and thank you very much for having me on again. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So I thought, as we're starting with Russia, what I'd mention was something that has occurred to me due to a few exchanges I've had with some people, and also some news that's actually going on at the moment. And it's about the perception of the Russian Navy, which may have embedded itself over the past few years due to the performance of the Black Sea Fleet, which I would say has been atypical, not typical of the entire Russian Navy, but also because of the nature of the Black Sea. And on the one hand, there was a person commented on a social media platform that the Russian Navy was mostly old-fashioned legacy platforms that you could wear out with escort duties for tankers in and out of the Baltic. And so not really to worry about, because if we carried on, we could wear them down and therefore, you know, we could get the edge on them. And then today, without wishing to date the podcast, but today the news has broken of the Royal Navy and other NATO navies shadowing a submarine called the RFS Novorossiysk, an improved diesel electric submarine, nominally attached to the Black Sea Fleet, but unable to get into the Black Sea where she should be because of the straits, the Turkish straits being closed at the moment. So her normal operating area, just to digress a bit to fill in the background, is the Mediterranean, but that has become more difficult for the Russian Navy since the Assad regime fell in Syria and the successors booted the Russian military out of Tartus, their main support facility in Syria. So submarines such as the Novorossiysk have been going from the Baltic or wherever into the Med, and then they've been a bit short on maintenance bases to keep them going. So a story that arose in the past few weeks was that the Novorossiysk had suffered some kind of mechanical failure or some other problem, and that had forced her to surface was in a bad way, and so would have to be withdrawn from the Mediterranean. And that does appear to have happened, though there's no definitive statement from the Russians about it, other than to say that it's a normal turnaround of a vessel on patrol. But the thing that struck me today was what Mr. Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, said. And I think this feeds into this narrative that the Russian Navy's not much cop, and if we just keep wearing it down, it won't be a problem. In that he went down to Slovenia, where there was the 71st annual session of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly. And during his keynote speech there, he said, referring to the Novorossiysk, which is slowly making her way back, presumably to the Baltic from the Mediterranean, and has been shadowed, as I said earlier, by NATO navies. And Mr. Rutte said in his speech to the 71st annual session of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly, "There is a lone and broken Russian submarine limping home from patrol. What a change from the 1984 Tom Clancy novel, The Hunt for Red October. Today, it seems more like the hunt for the nearest mechanic." And you could have a drum roll there for laughter amongst the delegates. But to finally get around to your views, James, which I'm sure are going to be fascinating on this, is the Russian Navy, despite all we might have discussed in the past and you've written about in the magazine, is it really a relic that's being worn down? And is Mr. Rutte correct in his depiction of the Russian Navy being a long way from the glory days of Scottish submarine captains taking out typhoon submarines, as happened in in the movie The Hunt for Red October? You know, is it a long way from that power? And are we just looking at a bunch of old wrecks, like broken down submarines and worn out surface ships? What's your analysis, briefly, of the state of the Russian Navy?
Well, yes, obviously we can look at how the Black Sea fleet has underperformed in the Black Sea. And as you said, you know, the geographical circumstances of that theater combined with Ukrainian adaptability and flexibility did mix in with Russian complacency and tactical errors, result in the Russians suffering some significant losses. But to suggest that the entire Russian Navy is no longer a threat and not something that NATO has to really worry about. One, I can imagine the NATO Secretary General is engaging in diplomatic messaging, suggesting that, well, we don't really need to worry about Russia. NATO is so superior at sea. And of course, in many respects, NATO is clearly superior at sea. And especially if you can depend on the United States in the event of a confrontation with Russia, the combat power the US Navy would bring to bear in the Atlantic and surrounding waters would be critical. But you have to remember that the Russian Navy is more than the Black Sea fleet. The Northern Fleet in particular, where Russia has its ballistic missile subs, which, of course, you know, to put it in simple layman's terms, can unleash nuclear hellfire on pretty much anywhere on the planet with their submarine-launched ballistic missiles with their multiple nuclear warheads each, and its various hunter-killer subs, in particular the latest Yasin, Yasin M-class boats. These are potent vessels. And its surface ships, yes, the Udaloys might be old, but they are still capable. And the way the Russians look to employ their naval forces together with land-based air power missile forces in carefully defined areas, for example, to ensure control of the, to contest control of the Norwegian Sea, the Barents Sea, to protect their northern bastion and the Kola Peninsula, as well as Russian surface units in the Baltic, which can hang pretty close to the coast now and still launch caliber cruise missiles at pretty much anywhere in Western Europe. You know, if you're going to degrade these threats, you have to get in pretty close to Russia itself. And you're not just facing the Russian Navy, you are facing the whole gamut of military capabilities that the Russians can bring to bear. And to return to the Northern Fleet, you know, we're not looking at a Battle of the Atlantic, we're not looking at a World War II style contingency where you're going to have Russian submarines out in the North Atlantic stalking convoys. For a start, why do you need to target a convoy when you can simply rain cruise missiles, perhaps along with cyber warfare against ports of embarkation, disembarkation in Western Europe to degrade port infrastructure? But a Yasin M operating in the North Atlantic can launch its caliber cruise missiles at targets 1,000 miles away. So from a UK perspective, if you imagine the different axes from where Russian submarine-launched cruise missiles could come from, whether an improved Kilo operating, such as the Novorossiysk, in the Western Approaches, the North Sea, a Yasin M out in the North Atlantic, the threat is complex, multi-directional. Tie that in with Russian air-launched cruise missiles, ground-launched weapons. It's going to be a problem. And when you look at the other submarine capabilities the Russians can bring to bear, their undersea warfare capabilities with Gugi, surface vessels and submarine assets, which can threaten key underwater infrastructure. Yep. Yes, you can dismiss the Russian Navy when you look at it, say, next to the US Navy. But against most European navies, and if you look at how the Russians will look to employ their naval capabilities, particularly their submarine forces, no, I wouldn't write them off. I wouldn't want to overestimate their capabilities. You know, the Russians have many weaknesses. We don't know about the quality of their personnel in actual high-end combat conditions. But at the same time, you know, as you shouldn't overestimate your enemy, you do not want to underestimate your enemy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing struck me when you were talking there about how the Russians could take out the ports, the port infrastructure, and, you know, make it all grind to a halt, was actually that was similar, or is similar, or could be similar to the Battle of the Atlantic, the Second Battle of the Atlantic, and that's World War II. And because when Churchill's issuing his Battle of the Atlantic directive in the spring of 1941, he actually zeroed in on the fact that it was not just about the escorts, not just about the U-boats, which were bad enough, you know, the escorts versus U-boats, getting that battle won, but and the Fokker Condors as well at the time, their long-range maritime strike aircraft, as it were. It was also about the ports and the fact that, that things were getting snarled up in the ports, that cargo wasn't being offloaded, that you didn't have the right people in the right ports, and why have you got these guys waiting to offload stuff here when you've got everything backed up in Liverpool or somewhere else like Southampton or wherever it is. So it is a multi-layered thing, and I just wondered, what is your opinion of the something else that's happened since last time you and I talked on the podcast? What's your opinion of the Atlantic bastion concept, such as it is at the moment, as much as we know so far? Because from my point of view, it strikes me that building on what you've just said, that rather than do what we want them to do, which is to come through the Greenland, Iceland, UK gap into that part of the Atlantic so we can use our Type 26 frigates and drones and aircraft and helicopters, etc., and attack submarines to seal it off and then destroy whatever comes into it. They wouldn't need to come through there. They could just sit in their home seas off Norway or even further, you know, the Greenland Sea, the Barents Sea, and do it from there. So the bastion concept is a nice, comforting way of thinking we can hold them at bay and control them if they come near us. But in fact, what we really need to do is to be able to go into their area and sort them out, like we did in the Cold War. What do you think about the bastion concept?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a great concept. But when you look at what the key roles of the Russian Navy are, and after contributing to the Russian strategic nuclear deterrent, their principal role is not the destruction of adversary ships or submarines. It's conventional strategic strike. And if the Russian Navy can have its ships and submarines operating in proximity to Russian shores or in more secure operating areas that they're comfortable with, and they can launch calibers 1,000, 1,200 miles away to a target and rely on their higher-end boats, the Yasin-Ms, which are believed to be the apex of Russian submarine capability, highly advanced boats, very taxing. Obviously, there, the Atlantic bastion is going to be very valuable if you can intercept those boats. But otherwise, yeah, it's you want to be going in and attacking at source. It's better to look at the 1980s, the Ford maritime strategy, which scared the hell out of the Soviets, rather than thinking, well, we're going to be replaying the Second Battle of the Atlantic. No, I think the Atlantic bastion concept is, of course, very sound.
Yeah, so you think it's sound in what way? In that it sterilises or seeks to sterilise the waters closer to us, but without people going into the Russian waters, it doesn't really... Does it really stop them launching their missiles against our port infrastructure or whatever?
I think that is the key. That is the key weakness, the key issue. But you know, we can take a defensive posture and think about how we deal with the enemy coming to us, or looking at them perhaps referring to the Cold War of, well, they're going to penetrate the Greenland, Iceland, UK gap. But do they actually need to penetrate the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap if they can sit back with sub and surface-launched cruise missiles? Are they envisioning having to fight the United States? In which case, then, yes, they would be wanting to get submarines out into the Atlantic because you need to close to hold targets in the United States at risk. But if it's a pure... confronting the Western Europeans, if it's just confronting the Europeans, if the United States is going to be sitting out of it, then that will drive Russian strategy in a different direction to if they're having to think about challenging the United States as part of a wider NATO conflict.
And do we really know what the American position is? Because the curious thing about, again, recent weeks, and we cover this in the mag, in the current mag, and we have a bit on it in the magazine that's just come out, the November edition, is that the USS Gerald R. Ford Carrier Strike Group, which is a powerful entity with its Arleigh Burke class destroyers, which have, you know, land attack cruise missiles, its carrier air wing with its strike jets. So, it's got offensive power, considerable offensive power. And it's been up in the high north on exercise, principally with the Norwegians, but also with the British. We've joined in a little bit, and part of that has also been use of the quick sink weapon to sink an old Norwegian frigate with a B-2 bomber, the same bomber that attacked Iran in the in 2025 earlier this year. And then there've been missile firings, of which another old Cold War Norwegian frigate was sunk as well, and a torpedo attack in the same series of firings against one of those frigates. And so on top of that, the Americans and the Norwegians and the British have deployed to Jan Mayen Island to try and sharpen defences there up in the real high north. Maybe as a sort of early warning about Russian activities, I don't know. So there seems to be a strange divide being created with the Americans carrying on business as usual with the USS Gerald R. Ford and the B-2 taking part in that exercise, and the Jan Mayen exercise too. But, you know, then you have other politicians saying, you know, we've got to just be in the Western Hemisphere and not be part of the confrontation with Russia, and maybe even not worry about China. And we'll come to that in a few minutes as well. So is that the fatal element of doubt in both the mind of European NATO and NATO overall, and the Russians as well, in that the Russians are trying to calculate, are we going to have to fight the Americans? What will we do with our Navy? Or can we just take care of these Europeans? And on the other side, the Europeans and the Canadians in NATO are thinking, are we really going to go solo and defending against Russia? And then you have business as usual with the Gerald R. Ford. Yep. So do you think that one of the problems we have at the moment with Russia, the Russians have it vice versa, is nobody knows what the heck the Americans are up to or would do?
Exactly. I think that's absolutely spot on. You know, we have the idiosyncrasies of the Trump administration where, you know, one minute they're talking about leaving the security of Europe to the Europeans, and then looking at focusing on the Western Hemisphere or confronting China. Then you have visible displays of American military power with the Gerald R. Ford strike group operating together with B-2s, which, that's going to be ascending chills down the collective spines in the Kremlin. The thought of, you know, what if we did make a move in the Black Sea or the Baltic region, or there's an incident over Poland? You know, are we going to be confronted by US-led maritime forces operating on our northern flank? Because, of course, you know, we talk about the Kola Peninsula, the Northern Fleet, as a real Russian strength, and it is, but it's also a key Russian weakness. And, against a combined US-led firepower involving a US carrier strike group, allied assets, you know, say, for example, if it was a British CSG was available, together with local allies, the Scandinavians now operating growing numbers of F-35s. You know, we have multi-domain capabilities that can be brought to bear, and those would be extremely challenging to the Russians to confront. But is the United States actually going to be there on the day if there is a crisis? Whether that crisis has turned kinetic, which of course we hope never happens, but in the event of a confrontation, you know, is there going to be an American carrier in the high north as the vanguard of a NATO deterrent? Or is the man in the White House going to be sitting back and posting about, well, the Russians aren't threatening to attack the United States. I don't really care what they are planning to do in Eastern Europe. And, well, maybe a European should have spent more on defence and, you know, do a deal with Putin. So that is a concern, of course, to the Europeans. You know, how do you frame defence decisions which have to necessarily take into account the long term and substantial amounts of money? You know, do you spend and plan for a purely European response? Do you plan for, well, yes, these are the contingency plans we've been working on for decades. We've got them. They're well rehearsed with the United States and hope for the best. I suppose you have to be pragmatic and you know, work with the United States day to day as happens and have those plans in place that, well, if the US is there, great, we follow those plans. But what happens if they're not there? Yeah. Tensions with Iran, tensions with North Korea, tensions with China. And we have to hold the fort whether confront Russia entirely on our own or know that the United States will join, but it might be limited at first. So it's, you know, prudent defence planning on the parts of the Europeans. Plan for the worst, hope for the best.
So I suppose straying into the territory of that famous book from the 80s, The Third World War, by General Sir John Hackett and others, you know, which imagined how a Third World War would have happened in its first, I think there were two books, in fact, but in the first one, with the Central Front in Europe and the war in the Atlantic, then they had certain things happen and things develop, but along a kind of predictable line, because, you know, it was certain the Americans would be there. So I suppose if somebody were to do a similar book today, one of the key things that could happen is that because the Russians think that they could get away with it and the Americans will sit it out, they gamble, and the Europeans are thinking, well, the Americans may or may not come in. They don't put up a proper defence, or they don't immediately go, you know, escalate to de-escalate. And then it ends up being the very kind of Third World War, or the, you know, European, broader European conflagration that Hackett imagined and that we don't want because of that uncertainty. So I think it's the uncertainty, isn't it, that's the very, very dangerous thing to both sides and to the continent and to Europe as a whole.
Absolutely. Obviously, strategic ambiguity can strengthen deterrence. But conversely, uncertainty over your own position and whether your strongest ally upon whom you have essentially become dependent over decades on would undermine your deterrence. The Russians know as much as anyone else does that in a straight-up NATO-Russia confrontation, if the United States is involved, the Russians are going to be put in a very bad situation very quickly, where they would have to think about, you know, do they back down or do they look to escalate to catastrophic levels? But if the United States is not involved, it gives Russia a hell of a lot more leeway. And, you know, to go back to the example of ports, you know, when you're looking at the Western economies being just in time, highly dependent on uninterrupted flows of both physical goods and digital goods, information, you know, finance, banking, precision navigation now, as well as, for example, in the UK's case on liquefied natural gas imports, can damage to port infrastructure, terminals, cause sufficient economic disruption that the possibility of a short clash that causes so much economic disruption that's not worth the cost of whatever the Russians are trying to secure, whether that's, you know, for example, coercing Western European states to end their support for Ukraine or over whatever. I think the uncertainty over Europe's strategic position is a considerable vulnerability. And, the Russians know it. They know that how they see the world is very different to how particularly the Western Europeans see the world. And that is something they can play up. And there are, I think, a great deal of risk involved in that, whilst we are not certain over what the United States' position is.
And then moving on as a segue, we come to Russia and its allies. So if we move on to North Korea, you mentioned the treaty, I believe. That was either before we started talking or when we started talking, I can't remember now. But you mentioned that there is a defence treaty between North Korea and Russia, and there have been North Korean troops in Ukraine fighting for Russia against Ukrainians and suffering probably heavy casualties. So can the Russians, in any scenario, let's say with Europe, and then we could talk about North Korea in general as a threat to the West, and here we're talking about the West as in Indo-Pacific as well. Can the Russians rely on the North Koreans to get involved in a punch-up with Europe? And would the North Koreans look at it as a good thing to do, because they're looking for a bit of a revenge for sanctions, to try and stop their nuclear program?
Obviously one of the huge effects of the Russia-Ukraine war has been to vividly highlight how interconnected security in the Euro-Atlantic is with security in the Indo-Pacific, and Russia and North Korea forming an alliance which includes a mutual defence clause, dramatically demonstrates that. And the fact that we have now seen North Korean ballistic missiles being used against European cities, Ukrainian cities, but still European cities. And of course, the North Koreans, they are providing Russia with, I think some estimates have said, up to 40% of Russia's artillery consumption in Ukraine is North Korean. They provided ballistic missiles to use. They're providing a lot of stuff. And what worries me is not so much, whether North Korea might do something to trigger a crisis in the Indo-Pacific, because the threat to North Korea is such, they know that the United States will very likely tackle them, along with the South Koreans and, of course, the Japanese. And they've always got to keep in the backs of their minds that if they are seen to provoke a conflict, then their mutual defence treaty with China would be void and the Chinese won't come to their assistance. What worries me more is what North Korea is getting in return for its assistance from the Russians. And the South Koreans are stating that there's Russian assistance for their missile programs. And in the naval domain, it's of particular relevance is the reports that have started last month, September, that the Russians are assisting North Korea in the development of their nuclear submarines, potentially including supplying complete nuclear reactor modules to go in their submarines. The North Koreans are believed to be working on a nuclear-powered ballistic missile sub, which would be comparable to the United States' first Polaris-armed boats from the late 50s, early 60s, their George Washington class. Now, obviously, the North Koreans, they're not going to be deploying a Bore equivalent or an Ohio class equivalent ballistic missile boat, but any Russian assistance in the field of nuclear submarine design, they have obviously vast experience that they can bring. That will help the North Koreans dramatically. And one, it getting into North Korean hands is bad enough, but will the North Koreans further proliferate that technology themselves? Will the Russians now hold the view that, well, for the right price, if you help us enough, we'll help you, and we know what really antagonizes the West. And well, look at the British and the Americans. They're helping Australia build nuclear-powered submarines. Why can't we help someone build a nuclear-powered submarine? You know, and you know, this is, I think, the real threat that Russia poses. Russia isn't a superpower now. You know, their economy is comparable to Spain, but they have an awful lot of technology, military technologies. They have extremely skilled and ruthless intelligence services. They can act as a geopolitical spoiler. And that, I think, is the real threat that the Russians pose to the West in the near to midterm. We can't dismiss the possibility that in the long term, a future Russian leadership could embark on the economic reforms that fully exploit Russia's immense natural resource wealth and its position by two of the biggest markets in the world, the European market, the Indo-Pacific market. So in the long term, you know, Russia might develop the economic muscle to match its wider ambitions. But in the near to midterm, the threat is more that Russia can act as a geopolitical spoiler. And of course, from a European perspective, without the deterrent power and combat power of the United States, then the Russian threat, in military terms, is much more considerable.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit, I suppose, the Russian state, which I've referred to before as being like, you know, it's a gangster state, you know, gangsters with nukes, and it's like a protection racket, isn't it? If you don't do what we want, you know, we're going to help your enemies, and or if you if you're not nice to us and you don't just treat us with the respect that we deserve, like some sort of the Godfather, you know, Putin being the Godfather and demanding respect from the world to kiss his ring, as it were. Yeah. Then we'll proliferate this stuff and we'll create mayhem. And I suppose that's the terrible situation we find ourselves in. It strikes me that it's what we're seeing now evolving around the world is 100 times worse than Ian Fleming might have imagined James Bond being sent out to tackle when he went to you know, see off maybe the North Koreans and the Russians, whatever they were called in the movies and the novels.
I suppose Ian Fleming wouldn't have written in that the United States had become, at best, of dubious reliability, and at worst, you know, going to sit out and be led by a chap who has perhaps a world outlook not too dissimilar to that of the adversary.
Yeah. And I was struck the other day when I was just in an idle moment. I don't get too many of those, but I was watching a video on YouTube, which was basically about late 1980s or even mid 1980s. Major exercises on land, sea, and in the air. And the thing we were talking about earlier, and you mentioned just then, really, is the certainty of knowing that the Americans were in there, and they were in there both feet, you know, feet first, you know, all in. And you know, there were these. I watched two or three of them actually, and there were American-made documentaries, and it was a British training film for the British Army, the Rhine, and various other things. And it was an absolute rock-solid certainty that America. This is where we will fight the battle, and this is how we'll fight it. And so now segueing, we maybe have finished with North Korea, maybe we'll come back to North Korea, but segueing now to China, there seems to have crept in a bit of doubt, even when it comes to, is America going to confront China? It goes back to that Western Hemisphere thing, you know, we'll do the Western Hemisphere, and you Russians and Chinese, you can carve up the rest of the world however you see fit. So do you think, in looking at your article in the new edition of the magazine, which is just out, the November edition, which is about what was on display at the September parade in Beijing of Chinese military might and what it means, particularly in a naval sense, do you think the Americans looking at that are thinking, yeah, we're ready to take you on if you have a go at Taiwan or anything else? Or are they really thinking that, I mean, maybe we don't know, it could go either way, but are they really thinking that they won't now confront China if it tries to up its aggression in Indo-Pacific beyond just the South China Sea and, you know, running off the Philippine Coast Guard and other people and snatching reefs to make into military bases. Are they thinking if the Chinese up the ante and go for Taiwan in 2 or 3 years' time, we won't bother with that because that's not our hemisphere? Do you think that is evolving, or does anybody know?
Ultimately, you know, I think at the grand strategic level, any potential contingency that emerged whilst Donald Trump is in the White House, there is always going to be a huge amount of uncertainty over what action the United States would take because of the idiosyncrasies of the man in charge. But in terms of were there to be a crisis between the United States and China in the near term, would the United States still feel confident that it would prevail? I believe it would. The Chinese, yes, their parade on the 3rd of September, they are showcasing the immense progress that they are making in their long-standing military modernization efforts. And these, you know, this effort goes back decades. And, you know, if you contrast it to, say, where they were in 2015 compared to where they hope to be in 2035, you know, you can see the growth that is occurring. And of course, the systems that they demonstrated on the 3rd of September are the ones that are most mature and either already operational or close to being operational, all familiar from open source reporting that there are things in China that are being allowed to be seen that are not yet parade ready, but are clearly next generation and highly advanced systems. So, you know, the Chinese are growing increasingly confident that they can show the products of their immense economic capabilities that they have. And, you know, this is a key difference between them and the Russians. You know, the Russians have the ambitions. They don't have the means to match those ambitions. The Chinese have the ambition and they have the technological and economic capacity to deliver on that. But in the near term, I would still suggest that the United States would hold the advantage, in particular that if there was to be some sort of conflict between the US and China in the Indo-Pacific, it is very likely that Japan would be on the side of the United States, Australia potentially, as well as other allies, depending on the circumstances. You know, you could look at the UK and France potentially contributing in certain ways, whether that would be to free up additional US forces from Europe to head out east, or whether, you know, contributing assets of our own. But you can also see what the Chinese are highlighting also is indicative of their thought on, you know, how future naval warfare is likely going to evolve and where they would need to be working. So, for example, highlighting unmanned underwater capabilities. The Chinese will know as much as anyone that the United States' undersea warfare capabilities are absolutely unparalleled. You know, those, even if the Chinese could defeat the, in the preemptive missile attack, the United States 7th Fleet and, you know, push back US surface forces to Hawaii, they would still have to contend with the US Navy's hunter-killer subs, and those Los Angeles, Virginia and Seawolf class boats would cause immense problems. So China would have its work cut out, as well as, you know, against Japanese diesel electric boats. So anti-submarine warfare is obviously something that the Chinese are working very hard on. And the whole gamut of capabilities that the US Navy and the US Air Force in particular bring to bear in the type of air-sea multi-domain battle you would be thinking of fighting in the Indo-Pacific. So unless there was some major red line crossed, such as Taiwan declaring independence or the United States recognizing Taiwan as an independent state, I don't think China is going to take the step yet of crossing that Rubicon and actively looking to confront the United States in a war. The balance of power, I think, still favours the United States. 10 years from now, possibly a different matter, especially, you know, if the United States doesn't get its own naval long-term program sorted out, where, you know, there's the uncertainty over the F/A-XX, the next generation fighter for the US Navy, delays to surface combatant construction, all those things. You know, obviously, the US is having to pay the bills that it built up in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you know, the Navy took something of a lower priority, and now, obviously, you know, the Chinese, their naval construction is in full swing, and you know, the US has slipped behind a bit. But the US Navy, I think, still has immense power that it can bring to bear, and you know, the sort of high-end fight that you'd be looking at in the Indo-Pacific. In the near term, you know, you would still put your money on the United States.
Thanks for listening to part one of my chat with James Bosbotanis, and don't forget to tune in for part two, and hopefully things will go with a bang as we look at the possibility of battleships coming back to life. And don't forget to check out the magazine itself. In our November edition, we did look at Donald Trump's call for new battleships, as well as a whole range of other topics, including the Indian Navy's new frigate, and also the latest with the UK carrier strike group and its deployment to Indo-Pacific. But above all, don't forget to check out the December edition of Warships IFR, which is being unleashed. And now, as November moves towards its close, and is in shops or available direct from Sundial magazines. And among the topics that we consider are Battleships Reborn. There's quite a section in there, 5 pages on that. And also in the news pages, the US Navy's Narcos Blitz in the Caribbean and also part of the Pacific against what it feels are cartels running drugs into America, and various issues connected with that. Also worth a read in the December edition is something on the Novorossiysk incident, that is the limping Russian submarine on the way home, and whether or not that actually illustrates the Russian Navy is in a severe state of decline. And James Bosbotanis has written about confronting the North Korea threat and how to do it without going nuclear. That's all in the December edition of Warships IFR magazine. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases, that's at Warships IFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at Warships IFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.